Side 18, The Tommyknockers by Stephen King. Continuing on page 523. 18. Kyle and Hazel relaxed. They looked at each other. There was an identical and very human expression in their eyes. The expression of people discovering something just too good to be true.
David Brown?
Kyle thought, unbelieving, at Hazel.
Is that what you pick up? Yes, he's trying to save the kid to bring him back. Back from Altair 4.
Then for a moment overriding the net, came Dick Allison's voice, excited and full of sour triumph.
Hot damn. I knew that kid would come in handy.
19. For a moment, Gardner felt nothing at all. He began to relax on the edge of a doze again. Then pain hit him in a single awful crunch, a destructive battering ram that would tear his head apart. No! He screamed. His hands went to his temples, beat against them. No, God, no, it hurts too much. Jesus, no!
Ride with it, son. Try to ride with it.
I can't. Oh, Christ, make it stop! This made his shattered ankle feel like a mosquito bite. He was dimly aware that his nose was bleeding and that his mouth was filled with blood.
Ride with it, son.
The pain backed off a little. It was replaced with another feeling. This new sensation was horrible, horrible and terrifying. Once, while in college, he had participated in something called the Great McDonald's Eat-Out. Five frats had fielded champion eaters. Guard had been Delta Tau Delta's champ. He had been on his sixth Big Mac, not even close to the contest winner's eventual total, and had become suddenly aware that he was very close to total physical overload. He had never felt anything like it in his life. In a gross way, it was almost interesting. His midsection felt thundery with food. He did not feel like vomiting. Nausea did not exactly describe what it had been like. He saw his stomach as a huge, still dirigible, lying bloated in still air at his center. He thought he could sense red lights going on in some mental mission control center as various systems tried to deal with this insane load of meat, bread, and sauce. He didn't vomit. He walked it off. Very slowly, he walked it off. For hours, he had felt like those drawings of Tweedledum and Tweedledee, his stomach stretched and smooth and terribly close to bursting. Now it was his mind that felt like that, and Jim Gardner understood as coldly and rationally as a trapeze performer who works with no net that he was on the knife edge of death. But there was another sensation, one which was unrelatable to anything, and for the first time he understood what the Tommyknockers were all about, what moved them, what propelled them onward. In spite of the pain, which had only retreated, not left, and in spite of that dreadful smooth feeling of being as stuffed as a python which has swallowed a kid, part of him was enjoying this. It was like a drug, an incredibly powerful drug. His brain felt like the engine in the biggest fucking Chrysler ever built, idling on fat gas, waiting for him to drop the car into gear and peel out.
Peel out to where? Anywhere. The stars, if he wanted. Son, I'm losing you.
That was the old man, sounding more exhausted than ever, and Gardner pulled himself back to the job at hand, the next piece of furniture he had to hop to. Oh, this feeling was drunkenly wonderful, but it was stolen. He forced himself to think again of those leaf-brown shapes locked in all those hammocks, galley slaves. The old man was powering him. He was drinking the old man like a vampire drinking blood. How long until he was a vampire himself, like them? He thought of Hillman.
I am with the old horse.
Ev Hillman closed his one good eye in silent relief. Guard turned to the monitor screen, absently holding the plug in his ear like a newsman on a live remote, listening to a question from the anchor back in the studio. In the closed face of Bobby Shedd, the light began to cycle up again. 20.
Listen.
They all listened. They were all on a party line which covered all of Haven, radiating out from a center about 2 miles from that still faint smudge of smoke. They were all on the net, and they all listened. They accepted no absolute common. Tommyknockers was a name they accepted as casually as any, but they were really interstellar gypsies with no king. Yet in this moment of crisis, during the period of regeneration, a period when they were so vulnerable, they were willing to accept the voices of those Gardner called the Shed people. They were, after all, the clearest distillation of them all.
The time has come to close the borders.
There was a universal sigh of agreement, a mental sound Ruth McCausland would have recognized, a sound like autumn leaves blown before a November wind. For the time being, at least, the shed people had lost all contact with Gardiner. They were only content that he was occupied elsewhere. If he meant to go to their ship, the fire would soon be in his way. The unified voice quickly explained the rota that was to be followed. Some of these plans had been made vaguely weeks ago. These plans had become more concrete as the shed people became. Gadgets had been made, haphazardly it had seemed. But birds flying south as winter approaches may seem haphazard. Their migration may even seem so to themselves, just something which felt like as good a way as any to spend the winter months. Want to go to North Carolina, dear? Of course, my love, what a wonderful idea. So they had built. And sometimes they had killed each other with their new toys, and sometimes they had finished gadgets, looked at them doubtfully, and packed them away somewhere out of sight, since they were no obvious help in their daily round. But some they had toted out to Haven's borders, usually in the trunks of cars or in the backs of trucks, under tarps. One of these gadgets had been the Coke machine, which had murdered John Leandro. It had been customized by the late Dave Rutledge, who had once serviced such machines for a living. One had been the Benson brush trimmer, which had cut up a storm on Lester Moran. There were duded-up televisions which shot fire. There were smoke detectors. Gardiner had seen some, but not all of these, on his first visit to the shed, which flew through the air like frisbees, emitting killing waves of ultrasonic sound. At several locations, there were force barriers. Almost all of these gadgets could be mentally activated with the help of simple electronic devices which were casually dubbed callers, not much different from the device Freeman Moss had used to float the drainage machinery into the woods. No one thought more about why these gadgets should be placed in a rough perimeter around the town than a bird thinks about flying south or a caterpillar thinks about weaving a cocoon. But, of course, this time always came, the time when the borders had to be sealed. This time had come early, but it seemed not too early. The shed people also suggested that a number of Tommyknockers go back to the village. Hazel McCready was designated to go with them. She would be the representative of the more advanced Tommyknockers. The stuff protecting the borders would run pretty much without supervision until the batteries were dead. In the village, there were more discretionary gadgets, which could be sent into the woods to form a protective net around the ship, in case the drunk made a break for it. And there was one other, very important gadget, which needed guarding on the off chance that anyone at all, should break through. This gadget sat in Hazel McCready's backyard like a one-ring circus under a large five-man tent. It was a safety net. It would do many of the things the transformer in the shed could do, but this thing, which had once been a furnace, was vitally different from the transformer in the shed in two respects. The galvanized aluminum pipes, which had once led to the ventilators in the various rooms of the McCready house, now all pointed skyward. Hooked up to this new and improved furnace, onto plywood ramps, protected from the elements by more of the silvery netting which lined the trench in which the ship lay, were 24 truck batteries. When this gadget was turned on, it would make air. Tommyknocker air. Once this small atmosphere manufacturing factory was in operation, they would no longer be at the mercy of winds and weather. Even in the event of a hurricane, the air exchanger, which had been surrounded by force shields, would protect most of them if they gathered in the village. The suggestion that the borders should be closed came as Gardiner was putting one of the transformer earphones into his own ear. 5 minutes later, Hazel and about 40 others had dropped out of the net and were headed back to town. Some to the town hall to oversee the borders and protect the ship with other gadgets. Some to make sure the atmosphere factory was protected in case of accidents, or in case the reaction from the outside world was quicker, more informed, and better organized than they expected. All these things had happened before, at other times, on other worlds, and affairs were usually concluded in a satisfactory fashion, but the becoming did not always have a happy ending. During the 10 minutes between the command to close the borders and the departure of Hazel's party, the size and shape of the smoke rising into the sky did not change appreciably. The wind was not rising much, at least not yet. This was good because the attention of the outside world would be slower in turning toward them. It was bad because Gardner would not be cut off from the ship so soon. Still, Newt, Dick, Adley, Kyle thought Gardner's goose was just about cooked. They held the remaining Tommyknockers in place for 5 minutes, waiting for mental notice that the gadgets along the borders were waking up, getting ready to do their job. This came as an awakening hum. Newt looked at Dick. Dick nodded. The two of them dropped out of the net and turned their attention back to the shed. Gardner, who had once been impossible for even Bobby to pick up, was still a tough nut to crack. But they should have been able to read the transformer with no trouble at all. Its steady, heavy pulses of energy should have been as easy for them to hear as RF interference on a TV or radio from the small motor in an electric mixer. But the transformer was barely a whisper, no more than the dim sound of the ocean in a conch shell. Newt looked at Dick again, frightened.
Jesus, he's gone. Motherfuckers.
Dick smiled. He did not believe that Gardner, who could still barely thought read or send at all, could have accomplished his purpose so quickly, if it had ever been possible for him to accomplish at all. The man's presence here and Bobby's perverse affection for him had been a nuisance, one which Dick now believed at an end. He winked one of his strange eyes at Newt. This odd mixture of human and alien was both hideous and hilarious at the same time.
Not gone, Newt. The asshole's dead.
Newt looked at Dick thoughtfully for a moment, then began to smile. They moved in, all of them together, drawing in toward Bobby's house like a tightening noose. 21.
Carrying a heavy head.
The phrase chimed constantly in the back of Guard's mind as he turned toward the monitor screen. It seemed to have been there for a long time. Once. And for a Jim Gardner that no longer existed, his poems had formed around such lines, like pearls around chips of grit.
Carrying a heavy head now, boss.
Was it from some chain gang movie, like Cool Hand Luke? A song? Yeah, some song. Something which seemed oddly mixed in his mind, something from the West Coast 60s. A waif-faced psychedelic flower child wearing a Hell's Angels jacket and carrying a bike chain wrapped around one thin white violinist's hand.
Your mind, Guard. Something happening to your mind. Yeah, you're fucking A, Big Daddy. I'm carrying a heavy head, that's what. I was born to be wild. I've been caught in the crosstown traffic, and if they say I never loved you, you know they are a liar. Carrying a heavy head. I can feel every vein, artery, and capillary in it swelling up, getting plump, standing out the way the veins on our hands used to when we were kids and wrapped a dozen rubber bands around our wrists and left them there to see what would happen. Carrying a heavy head. If I looked into a mirror right now, I know what I'd see. Green light spilling out of my pupils like the pencil beams of flashlights. Heavy head. And if you joggle it, it will burst. Yes, so be careful, Guard. Be careful, son. Yeah, old man, yeah. David. Yeah.
That feeling of dipping and swaying out over the drop. He remembered the news film of Carl Walenda, the grand old man of the aerialists falling from the wire in Puerto Rico, gripping for the line, finding it, holding for a minute, then gone. Gardner dismissed it from his mind. He tried to dismiss everything from his mind and prepared to be a hero. Or die trying. 22. Program? Guard pushed the earphone deep into his ear and frowned at the screen, drove the heavy ram of his thoughts toward it, felt pain flare, felt the balloon of his brain swell a little more. The pain faded. The feeling of increased swelling remained. He stared at the screen. Altair 4. Okay, what next? He listened for the old man to tell him, but there was nothing. Either his mental link to the transformer had excluded the old man, or the old man didn't know. Did it really matter which? Nope. He looked at the screen. Cross file with... The screen suddenly filled up with nines, from top to bottom and side to side. Gardner stared at this with consternation, thinking, "Oh, Jesus Christ, I broke it." The nines disappeared for just a moment. "Oh, Jesus Christ, I broke it." Glimmered on the screen like a ghost. Then the screen showed, "Cross file ready." He relaxed a little. The machine was okay, but his brain really was stretched to capacity, and he knew it. If this machine, which was being powered by the old man and whatever was left of Peter, could bring the boy back, he might actually be able to walk away, or hop, considering his ankle. But if it was going to try to draw from him as well, his brain would pop like a party noisemaker. But this really wasn't the time to think of that, was it? Licking his lips with his numb tongue, he looked at the screen.
Cross file with David Brown.
Nines across the screen. Nines for eternity.
Cross file successful.
Okay, good. What next? Gardner shrugged. He knew what he was trying to do. Why dance?
Bring David Brown back from Altair 4.
Nines across the screen. Two eternities this time. Then a message appeared which was so simple, so logical, and yet so loony, the guard would have screamed laughter if he hadn't known to do so would be to blow every working circuit he had left.
Where do you want to put him?
The urge to laugh passed. The question had to be answered. Where indeed? Home plate at Yankee Stadium, Piccadilly Circus? On the breakwater, jutting out from the beach in front of the Alhambra Hotel? None of those places, of course not, but not here in Haven. Christ, no, even if the air didn't kill him, which it probably would, his parents were turning into monsters. So where? He looked up at the old man, and the old man was looking back at him urgently, and suddenly it came to him. There was really only one place to put him, wasn't there? He told the machine. He waited for it to ask for further clarification, or to say it couldn't be done, or to suggest a system of commands he would be unable to execute. Instead, there were more nines. This time, they stayed forever. The green pulsing from the transformer became almost too bright to look at. Guard closed his eyes, and in the greenish deep-sea darkness behind his lids, he thought he could hear, faintly, the old man screaming. Then the power that had filled his mind left. Bingo, it was gone. Just like that. Gardner staggered backward, the earphone popping free and hitting the floor. His nose was still bleeding, and he had soaked a fresh shirt. How many pints of blood were in the human body? And what had happened? There had been no
transfer successful,
or
transfer unsuccessful,
or even
a tall, dark commie knocker will enter your life.
What had it all been for? He realized miserably that he was never going to know. Two lines of Edwin Arlington Robinson came to him. So on we worked and waited for the light, and went without the meat and cursed the bread.
No light, boss. No light. If you wait for it, they'll burn you in your tracks, and here's a fence. Ain't even half whitewashed yet.
No light. Just a dull, blank screen. He looked toward the old man, and the old man was lolling forward, head down, exhausted. Gardner was crying a little. His tears were mixed with blood. Dull pain radiated from the plate in his head, but that stuffed, near-to-bursting feeling was gone. So was the sense of power. He missed the ladder, he discovered. Part of him longed for it to come back, no matter what the consequences.
Get moving, guard.
Yes. Okay. He had done what he could for David Brown. Maybe something had happened. Maybe nothing. Maybe he had killed the kid. Maybe David Brown, who had probably played with Star Wars action figures and wished he could meet an E.T. like Elliot had in the movie, was now just a cloud of dissipating atoms somewhere in deep space between Altair 4 and here. It was not for him to know. But he had reached this piece of furniture and held it long enough. Too long, maybe. He knew it was time to move on. The old man raised his head.
Old man, do you know? If he's safe? No. But then you did your best, I thank you. Now please. Please, son, please.
Fading. The old man's mental voice was fading.
Please let me out of this. Down a long hallway and look on one of those shelves back there.
Now Gardner had to strain to hear.
Please. Oh, please.
Faint. A whisper. The old man's head lolling forward. remains of thin white hair floating in green brew. Peter's legs moved dreamily as he chased rabbits in his dim sleep, or looked for Bobby, his darling. Guard hopped over to the back shelves. They were dark, dusty, greasy. Here were old forgotten bus fuses and a Maxwell House can full of bolts and washers and hinges and keys with locks whose location and purpose had long since been forgotten. On one of these shelves was a Transco Sonic Space Blaster, another kid's toy. On the side was a switch. He supposed the child who had received this for his birthday used it to make the gun ululate at different frequencies. What did it do now?
Who gives a fuck?
Gardner thought wearily.
All this shit has become one big dumb bore.
Bore or not, he put the gun in his belt and hopped back across the shed. At the door, he looked back at the old man.
Thanks, Guy.
Faint, fainter, faintest, a dry rustle of leaves.
Out of this, son. Yes, you and Peter both, you bet.
He hopped outside and looked around. No one else had come yet. That was good, but his luck couldn't hold much longer. They were there. His mind touched theirs like a couple waltzing with the care of strangers. He sensed them linked in a
net,
single consciousness. They were not hearing him, feeling him, whatever they did. Either using the transformer or just being in the shed had cut his mind off from theirs. But they'd soon know that, like Elvis, fat, flailing, but game and blindly bopping just the same, he had made a comeback. The sunshine was dazzling. The air was hot, full of a burning stink. Bobby's farmhouse was blazing like a heap of dry kindling in a fireplace. As he watched, half the roof fell in. Sparks, nearly colorless in the bright declining day, rushed up to the sky in a flume. Dick, Newt, and the others had not observed much smoke because the fire was burning hot and colorless. Most of the smoke they'd seen had come from the burning vehicles in the dooryard. Guard stood for a moment on his good leg in the shed doorway, and then hopped for the whirligig. He made it about halfway and then sprawled full length in the dust. As he came down, he thought of the Sonic Space Blaster in his belt. A kid's toy. No safety on a kid's toy. If the trigger was depressed, the essential Gardner might suddenly be drastically reduced. The Tommyknocker weight loss plan. He took the toy gun out of his belt, handling it as if it were a live mine. He crawled the rest of the way to the whirligig on his hands and knees, then pulled himself up. 40 feet away, the other half of Bobby's roof collapsed. Hot sparks whirled toward the garden and the woods beyond. Guard turned toward the shed and thought again as hard as he could.
Thank you, my friend.
He thought there was an answer. Some weary, faint answer. Gardner pointed the toy at the shed and pulled its trigger. A green ray no thicker than a pencil lead shot out of its muzzle. There was a sound like bacon frying in a skillet. For a moment, the green beam splashed from the side of the shed like water from a hose, and then the board burst into flame.
More hot work,
Gardner thought wearily.
Smokey the Bear wouldn't dig me at all.
He began to hop toward the back of the house, the Sonic Space Blaster in his hand. Sweat and bloody tears ran down his face.
Winston Churchill would have loved me,
he thought and began to laugh. He saw the tomcat, and then his jaws spread in another big yawn. It occurred to him that possibly Bobby had saved his life without even knowing it. In fact, it was more than possible, it was likely. The Valium could have protected him from the full force of the unimaginable power load that transformer carried. It might well have been the Valium which... Something inside the burning house, one of Bobby's gadgets, exploded with an artillery shell bang. Guard ducked his head instinctively. Half of the house seemed to suddenly lift off. The far side of it, fortunately for Gardner. He looked up into the sky, and a second yawn turned into a large, stupid gape.
There goes Bobby's Underwood.
It flew up and up, a typewriter in the sky, whirling and turning. Guard hopped on. He reached the Tomcat. The key was in the ignition, that was good. He'd had enough troubles with keys to last him the rest of his life, what little might remain. He pulled himself up onto the seat. Behind him, vehicles approached and turned into the dooryard. He didn't turn around to look. The Tomcat was parked too close to the house. If he didn't get moving right now, he was going to bake like an apple. He turned on the key. The Tomcat's motor made no sound, but that didn't bother him. It was vibrating faintly. Something else exploded inside the house. Sparks drifted down and prickled his skin. More vehicles turning into the yard. The minds of the arriving Tommyknockers were turned toward the shed, and they thought,
Baked Apple, he's baked inside the shed. Dead in the shed, right, yes.
Good. Let them think that. The new and improved Tomcat wouldn't clue them in. It was as noisy as a ninja. And he had to go. The garden was already on fire, the giant sunflowers and huge cornstalks with their giant, inedible ears of corn blazing. But the path down through the middle of the garden was still passable.
Hey, he's behind the house. He's alive. He's still...
Gardner looked to his right, dismayed, and saw Nancy Voss roaring across the stony field which lay between Bobby's place and the stone wall at the edge of the herd property. The Voss woman was on a Yamaha trail bike. Her hair was tied in braids which flew out behind her. Her face was a harridan's glare, although she still looked like Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm next to Sissy, Gard thought.
Hey, back here! Oh, you bitch,
Gardner thought, and raised the sonic space blaster. 23. 20 or 30 of them had entered the yard. Adley and Kyle were among them. So were Frank Spruce, the Goldens, Rosalie Skian, and Pop Cooter. Newt and Dick were back by the road, keeping all in order. All of them turned toward,
Here, back here, alive, the son of a bitch is still...
Nancy Voss had screamed. They all saw her charging across the field on the bike, looking like a jockey riding a hard-charging horse as the Yamaha's tough suspension system bounced her up and down. They all saw the green pencil beam shoot out from behind the burning house and envelop her. None of them saw the whirligig as it started to turn again. 24. One whole side of the shed was in flames. Part of the roof fell in. Sparks swirled in a fat spiral. One landed in a pile of greasy rags, and they bloomed with fire roses.
Deliverance,
Ev Hillman thought.
Last thing of all. Last thing.
The transformer began to pulse a brilliant green for the last time, for a moment or two rivaling the fire. 25. Dick Ellison heard the creak of the whirligig. His mind was filled with a furious, feral cry of rage as he realized Gardner was still alive. All of it happened fast, very fast. Nancy Voss was a flaming rag doll in the field to the right of Bobby's house. Her Yamaha ran on for 20 yards, struck a rock, and turned a back-over flip. Dick saw the burned hulks of Bobby's truck, Moss's truck, the Bozeman's old, and then he saw the whirligig.
Get away from that thing, get away.
But there was no chance. Dick had fallen out of the net, and he couldn't get past the two thoughts that beat out like a primitive rock and roll backbeat.
Still alive behind the house. Still alive behind the house.
More people were arriving. They were moving across the dooryard in a tidal flow, ignoring the blazing house, the blazing shed, the guttering, blackened vehicles.
No, fucking damn fools, no, get down, get away.
Mesmerized, Newt was staring at the inferno of the house, ignoring the whirligig spinning faster and faster, and in that moment Dick could cheerfully have killed him. But he still needed him, and so he contented himself with pushing Newt rudely to the ground and falling on top of him. A moment later, the green parasol spread its delicate web over the yard again.